Welcome to study of Bhagavad Gita. Each session, I begin by sharing teachings that Yogacharya O'Brien shared in the past. And then I share a few thoughts of my own, and we have time for comments. So let's begin by turning within. And opening our hearts and minds to the infinite indwelling Lord of Love. We acknowledge the saints and sages of all traditions. And we offer our gratitude and respect, especially to the gurus in this lineage of Kriya Yoga, who have brought forth insights about the teachings found in the Bhagavad Gita. May our time together be inspiring and uplifting, and may it support us in awakening our inner knowing, our intuitive knowing. Om, peace, peace. Peace. We're continuing our contemplation of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And today we're focusing on verse 55 of chapter 2, which is the beginning of Lord Krishna's response to Arjuna's question: what does steadfast wisdom look like? How does one who is established in higher consciousness live? How do they experience samadhi? How do they sit? How do they speak? How do they walk? In verse 55, the Lord said, "When a person completely casts off all desires of the mind and is satisfied in the self by the self, then that one is said to be of steady wisdom." This is the first response to Arjuna's question, which then continues for several more verses. What does steady wisdom look like? And this verse really reveals the heart of it. It gives us the what and the how. But we remember that Arjuna's question has four parts to it. What does it look like? What is steadfast wisdom for one who is immersed in samadhi or spiritual super consciousness? And then, how is that higher consciousness carried forth into action in the world? How does that person speak? How do they sit? And how do they walk? And in our last session, we really addressed those questions specifically: how do they speak? So, what teaching is provided in this first response from Lord Krishna? The key teaching of this tells us that desires that cloud the mind must be renounced and let go. And the highest and most effective way that that happens is to be immersed in super consciousness, aware and continual abidance in our higher self, the divine self, our true self, our essence of being. Such a mind then is no longer clouded. It's no longer clouded by the restless craving that's indicative of Rajas Guna, wanting, 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 or the heaviness of Tamas Guna that brings sorrow and despair and depression. In this state, the mind is in super consciousness. It is sattvic. It's clear. It's luminous. And then one is able to live spontaneously by the wisdom of the soul because buddhi can receive it. It's clear. Freedom from restless desire, then one is satisfied in the self by the self. You remember that prayer from the Upanishads, all this is full, all that is full. When fullness is taken from fullness, only fullness remains. So this is a direct experience of our innate wholeness, our fullness. And in that experience of the reality of our wholeness, or fullness, we're freed from the error thinking. We need more and more and more. We need something to complete us. That drive for more and more, or wanting something, that drive is a function of ego-based identity. That function of the mind that creates or posits a sense of separate self. And due to this function of what the ego is and what it does, that function of the mind cannot recognize wholeness or fullness because it is programmed as separate self. Whatever is separate and identifies as separate can never experience wholeness and fullness because it's always partial. That's the function of it. And it's necessary. We live in a realm of duality. There's light, there's dark, there's heavy, there's not heavy. All of it, it's a realm of duality. So we need that. That's its function. However, when it's in charge, it's always striving for something. It's always striving to become something, something to be added on, something to be acquired. Because it thinks it's not enough. So only when this ego function of the mind, or ahamkara, the eye maker, only when that is dismantled through the realization of our essential self, only then can we know the satisfaction of being in the self, by the self, our higher true self. This brings on a new spiritual operating system. And then out of that, there can be spontaneous right action because there's no longer this sense of asking, how am I going to succeed? How am I going to get mine? How am I going to do this? How am I going to be okay? There's freedom from that. One of the great benefits of going on a meditation retreat for several days is having the conditions arranged to remove external distractions and to support us to meditate more deeply. It gives us an opportunity to focus on that need. And then through repeated experiences of meditation, the mental field starts to become calmer naturally and to become clearer. And we observe the lessening of these internal distractions where we're being pulled away from the central experience of our own wholeness, our own fullness. This is why after a meditation retreat, we leave feeling renewed. Because all that energy that's expended trying to get something to prop ourselves up is released. And even brief experiences of superconsciousness, of this innate beingness, give us a state of, give us a taste of sufficiency, of our wholeness. We notice that restless desires that we feel to go, to do, to have, to acquire, to accomplish, to attain, they all start to fall away. We can observe it. And partially in the atmosphere of a meditation retreat, if we're dedicated enough and we stay long enough, then we notice that we're content to simply be. That is, being satisfied in the self by the self. You all know when you're on retreat, you can watch this happening. You can metacogitate. You come in, and we always begin our retreats by saying, you know, think about your preparations to arrive, you know, and then packing your suitcase, or if you're coming here, packing your notebook. If you're staying overnight, packing your suitcase. What did it take? The road was wide. We were on a highway, a freeway, and it gets narrower, more and more narrow, and we arrive. We can watch it. And this is one of the great benefits of being on a meditation retreat, because if you are a householder, you're in the world all the time, the world of activity. On retreats, you have enough time to meditate, to allow yourself to have that experience. And of course, daily meditation helps and is supportive of that. But the gurus in our tradition recommend regular time away on meditation retreat so that you can have that deep experience. And a little sidebar, Sister Prabhama is sitting in this room, and I know she's thinking, yes, I keep inviting you all to come here and be on meditation retreat. So come to a program, or come and just let yourself be at the ashram. Let yourself be on retreat. Okay. So we invite ourselves to be in environments that support our meditation. Retreats help with that. We also study and we learn about the mind. We learn what we're dealing with the mental field and its various functions. We learn about that in the Bhagavad Gita. We learn about that by studying Samkhya philosophy in particular. Chitta as a field of awareness, then the sense mind, manas, that is connecting us to the senses and acting on that perception, buddhi, our faculty of discernment that can guide our action, and ahamkara, the eye maker or the ego function. We begin to see through our study how this all operates. And that's really helpful. We begin, in essence, to learn about this operating system and to be able to witness our mental activity and to discern what is arising in the mental field, and also to intuit that we can have spontaneous awareness that's not coming through some logical process. We are receiving soul wisdom directly. Understanding the construct of parts of the mental field, in essence, understanding this construct helps us when we experience through our meditation or flashes of this direct experience or insight of what we are as the self, the unchanging witness, then we know by knowing. And these verses are about becoming established in that knowing, not falling away from it, not getting caught up in egocentric drives. What this is telling us is that when one becomes established in that self-knowing, higher self-knowing, then the ego is transformed. So instead of operating from this viewpoint of the separate self, which is that wanting creature, the ego becomes purified. It becomes purified and established in our true self, one with spirit, one with God. There's no interference. There's just wholeness. There's no separateness. Being satisfied in the self, by the self, transforms that ego operating system. And that is available to each of us. Each one of us can experience that. Here's Baba Hari Das's commentary on this Gita verse. He wrote, "As soon as the ignorance that veils the intellect is removed, the ego, which was rooted in the intellect, is transcended, and the individual consciousness becomes one with the higher self. In this state, there is no discontentment of any kind. There is only complete bliss, which is identified in this verse as satisfied in the self by the self." So we can see as beginners on the path, one of the things that we are to practice is contentment. Now, a little sidebar. Perhaps you all have had this experience. I remember early on coming onto the path, studying, living the eternal way, going to these 12-week courses. I remember Yogacharya telling me year after year, you need to practice contentment. I had no idea how to do it. How do you do that? If you're discontent, how do you become content? Well, this verse is telling us that. She goes on, we're getting ready for this. We start rooting out our discontent and start learning how to cultivate contentment. It doesn't come all at once. It might come as a flash. But then we root it out. Sidebar. This is why it's so useful to be part of the gardening team. Now, I'm not trying to be like, what is it, Vanna White, selling you something, because later we're going to talk about how that's not a good idea. However, when we're working in the garden here, or of course in your own garden, when we're working in the garden here, we're guided by the leaders to consider that every time we remove a weed, we're rooting out discontent. And every time we plant something, we're planting a positive thought. So, of course, do that in your garden at home. You know, every time we dust, we're removing clouds from the mind. Okay. Yogacharya goes on to say, the ego self, due to its craving for worldly enjoyments, creates its own pain, miseries, and restless mind. And when that craving has subsided, then the ego does not live in any kind of delusion. But instead, It finds its real and fundamental nature, which is the pure self-existence, consciousness, bliss solidified. It is called the self being satisfied in the self. And such a person's wisdom is said to be fixed in God or the higher self. Yogacharya says, when I was reviewing this verse, I thought of a verse attributed to Buddha. The sayings of Buddha from Dharmakshetra, because this is really about the dismantling of avidya, wrong knowledge of what we are, ignorance. In the Dhammapada, there's this verse that the Buddha says, vainly I sought the builder of my house through countless lives. He's asking, like, what is the cause of this body mind? Vainly I sought the builder of my house through countless lives. I could not find him. What is the source of this mind? How hard it is to tread life after life. But now I see you, O builder, and never again shall you build my house. I have snapped the rafters, split the ridgepole, and beaten out desire. And now my mind is free. I've seen the builder of the house and snapped the ridgepole. What's holding it up? That house can be built no more. Avidya, ignorance, wrong knowledge. The primary error is the ridgepole. Ignorance of the true self. The ego operating system is snapped. Here's a beautiful poem by Rumi. It starts out saying, something happens, call it grace. So lovely. He says, this is how a human being can change. There's a worm addicted to eating grape leaves. Suddenly he wakes up. Call it grace, whatever. Something wakes him, and he's no longer a worm. He's the entire vineyard, and the orchard too, and the fruit. A growing wisdom and joy that does not need to devour. These descriptions that we're encountering, starting with verse 55, the description of an awakened sage of steadfast wisdom, these are intended to indicate practices for those of us on the spiritual path. In verse 55, for those of us who are students of yoga, you will likely see that it is akin to Yoga Sutra 1.12, where instruction is offered on how to steady the mind in meditation through abhyasa, repeated experiences of super consciousness, the self abiding in the self, and by vairagya, renunciation. Renunciation. Here the Lord indicates that all the desires of the mind are cast off. So we can start to investigate, what are the desires of the mind, of my mind? And it doesn't take long for us to recognize that they are innumerable. They are going on 24/7, whether we're awake or asleep. In the Vedic system, they have so many wonderful classifications to help us think about the structure of how things work. So that can help us to dismantle it. And one of the systems offers teachings that puts our desires into four different categories. There probably are more, but here are the four main categories. There's vasana, which is the unconscious, subtle, unmanifest seeds of desire. These are latent tendencies, latent desires, or impressions in the mental field. They are conditioned limitations that exist, or predispositions toward something. A latent potency or residual impression, something that clings to that individual. It's also called a samskara. I can hear you thinking that. A latent impression. It's a latent desire to be fulfilled. Vasana. And then there's spriha, which is the feeling of longing or craving. The feeling of longing or craving in the absence of a desired object. It's an eager desire. And this could also be called envy or covetousness, like seeing something that someone else has and wanting it. We feel envious of. We have this desire in us for it. And then there's iccha, which is a wish or yearning to possess things that we want and hang on to things that we want, and to be free of those things that we do not want. And this desire is connected with the power of will. It's the power of will that we have to bring something about. It's like a wish or intention. And then there's trishna, which is a Sanskrit word for thirst. It's the desire to have more and more, no matter how much we have. The desire to want more and more, even if what we have is sufficient. It's an insatiable desire or craving. And this verse has explained that the mind of one of steadfast wisdom, who is established in samadhi, is free from desire. So then we might naturally ask, until we are established in samadhi, is there any hope for us? Yes, Yogacharya says, yes, there is hope. I want to finish today with some strategies for reducing our desires. When I think about strategies for reducing desires, I remember a time, Yogacharya says, when I was out at Mount Madonna Yoga Center up in the mountains, and I was wearing a lovely dress from India. Who knows why I was wearing it there, but I was. And I was walking from one building to another, and there was a group of women yogis who served there who were standing outside chatting. And as I came to them, they commented on the beauty of what I was wearing. And I started to tell them where I got it and how it could be received. Then one replied so clearly. She said, "Oh no, we don't want one. We were just appreciating." That's a practice, isn't it? To learn how to appreciate without the desire to possess. And there are some ways that we can do that. I was thinking, well, we can call this name that desire game. Name it and let it go. So name it. See where it's coming from. Inquire about it. Is it something I need or want for a good reason? What do I imagine fulfilling that desire will give me? And is it a reasonable assumption that it will give me that? How long will it last? What will it actually bring? Will it contribute to peace? Will it contribute to my well-being? Will it bring greater freedom or greater bondage or confusion? We can take those four categories of desire that we just went over and play around with them. Let's say number one in the game, spotting of vasana. So there are those samskaras hidden from view. But as they come into view, sometimes we can spot them. We can spot the drive or the tendency arising. And one example of this is that sometimes we can think, well, it's harmless to, let's say, peruse a magazine, to just enjoy the things that are being advertised to us there, and think, I'm not going to get these things. I'm just appreciating the beauty of how my kitchen would look with this appliance in it, or how my car might look with those kind of wheels. Whatever it is that you're just allowing yourself to peruse, then you might notice that an impression is planted in the mental field, even though it seems that you were just window shopping. The key is you're still shopping, because then later, when the opportunity arises, you might notice yourself fulfilling it. You go and get the new wheels, but you don't even need them. Your appliances are fine, but you somehow end up purchasing the one you saw in the magazine. So watch this and see how it happens. See what goes on in the mental field. And when you're doing that, realize that you're planting seeds. You're planting seeds of your own freedom, or you're not. It's just a question. It's part of the game. Notice the power of impressions. Sometimes we experience desires coming up out of our youth, out of our childhood. Something we wanted early on, we don't even want anymore. But we didn't have it then, and there's still the desire for it. Or maybe it's something that other people wanted for you that you didn't even want yourself. So with spotting these vasanas, you can kind of play with them like that. And then Spriha, we can ask ourselves, is it appreciation or is it covetousness and envy? Is our appreciation of something tainted by what he has, what she has, that I don't have yet and I want? Watch for trying things on in your mind. Yogacharya says, the other day I went for a walk with a friend. And she pulled up to my house in her new electric bike. And it was so beautiful. It had bamboo fenders, which were just so lovely. I had to watch myself thinking, how beautiful this bike is. And wouldn't it be nice for me to have a bike like that? I don't need a bike like that. But you just watch where your mind goes. And then with Ichcha, the yearning that engages the power of will to bring forth what we want and be free from what we don't want, it's not that we should never use this power of will to manifest. Yogananda Ji was very strong on using our will, but he called it wisdom-guided will. A clear buddhi that is able to bring forth what is actually needed, what is actually going to be supportive, but we need to learn to use it consciously. Sometimes this form of desire is like an open program running in the background of the mind. And then we're caught off guard when we manifest our will. We may not do it in the best way. For example, I've seen many people over the years who are immersed in this mental state of hating their job and really wanting to be free of it and talking about that, but then not knowing how to leave, and then being upset or surprised when they're laid off or fired. And not seeing that connection with Icha. This is the desire that is will. And Krishna, the meaning for this word is thirst. And that refers to wanting more and more. And I think this is interesting because Krishna, the Lord, Supreme Consciousness, is the satisfaction of all desire. And Krishna, as thirst, is the opposite of that. It is inflamed desire, wanting more and more and more. No matter how much we have, it isn't enough. And the advertising world is so aware of this, especially AI. You might notice that when you're buying something online, you're immediately offered a deal to buy two or three. You might even notice your own scarcity thinking coming in, like, oh, this thing is great. Maybe I should get two in case they run out or in case something goes wrong. This is my name the desire game. Just play with it and see if you can dismantle things in a playful way. The key element to understanding how it's possible that all of these different forms of desire can be renounced is to remember that these desires are not innate. They're not part of our higher self. They are constructs of our thinking, constructs of our mind. And because their properties are simply imprints in the mental field, they don't arise from the true self. Because of this, they do not affect the true self. This is the wisdom that is imparted to us in this verse, because it specifies the desires of the mind contrasted with being content in the fullness and wholeness of the self. Let me just touch on verse 56 and a few more things we can do before we close this session. Verse 56 is telling us that we reach a place where we are not driven by outer conditions. One whose mind is not agitated in misfortune, whose desire for pleasures has disappeared, whose passion, fear, and anger have departed, and one whose meditation is steady is said to be a sage. So we see here that this is referring to being free from being driven by outer conditions, meaning the conditions around us and the conditions of our own mental field. And in the next session, we'll talk about several practices that can help us to abide in the fullness of the self by the self. So, again, how do you add anything to that? I have just a little bit to share, and I'm calling this curbing desire and finding steady wisdom about verse 55 of chapter 2. When one thoroughly casts off all cravings of the mind and is satisfied in the self by the self, then one is said to be of steady wisdom. This points to a pivotal moment for us on the spiritual path when a seeker becomes a sage. When the storms of desire no longer sweeps away the light of discernment. This is a very important verse. The questions in the previous verse helped us to recognize where we get off track. This is the answer of how we get back on track and stay here. And in chaotic times, with politically, socially, personally, this verse offers us a way to stand in clarity rather than confusion, to stand in serenity rather than struggle. Wow. We need that. We need that. Desire is described in the Gita as one of the root causes of suffering and delusion. And left unchecked, it multiplies endlessly. But it's never satisfied. It's always reaching outward. And the great masters of yoga remind us what we truly long for is not another experience, but rather inner fulfillment. That which arises when we are united with our higher self. So how do we curb desires? You know, I don't need to tell you what people are desiring. We're all desiring peace on earth. We're all desiring ethical leadership, let's just call it that. We're all desiring peace and clarity in our own life. How do we curb desires that are not leading us to fulfillment? Not through repression, but through redirecting them through realization. So, you know, the first thing is superconscious meditation. And Kriya Yoga specifically purifies the nervous system and calms the restless mind. All of the practices of Kriya Yoga are for this purpose, as prana is withdrawn from the senses and brought inward, our identification shifts from the body and its cravings to the soul and our natural peace. Roy G. wrote, when the life force is withdrawn from the senses and centered in the spine, the consciousness is interiorized. Then desires cease to control the mind. So superconscious meditation, all of the practices of Kriya Yoga. The next one is Swadhyaya, study of truth, regular contemplation of scriptures, especially Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutras, reveal the impermanence of worldly pleasures and awakens our discernment, vivekha. And then reading about the lives of saints and sages inspires dispassion. It lets us know that it's possible. These are great sages. Well, we'll just go with these three and beyond. They're great sages. They are human beings. This inspires us and it reminds us of the joy that can be found in renunciation. So superconscious meditations, vajrayana, pranayama and breath work, even very simple breath regulation, such as just observing the breath or practicing alternate nostril breathing. This cools the fire of desire. And breath is the bridge between body and mind. So when we steady our breath, the mind calms and these desirous passions begin to dissolve. And then divine remembrance, Ishvara Pranidhan, surrendering our desires into divine will. You know, people sometimes ask about what is all this about the deities, about Dakshinamurti, about Shiva, about Krishna, about the Buddha statues, now about the meditating Jesus statue. What is this all about? Well, this gives us a place to remember our higher self and to surrender our desires, to transform yearning into devotion. So we stop asking, what do I want? And we begin living the prayer, what do you want? What do you want, God? What do you want through me? Yogacharya Umaji wrote, renunciation is not giving up everything. It is giving up the small for the sake of the infinite. So, you know I like threes, three practical applications. Name the desire when it arises. I like that game. And ask, is this a soul need or an ego craving? Number two, I say this every session, pause, breathe, and redirect. So use a mantra or an affirmation to bring the mind back to center. You can have an affirmation when you notice a desire. Desireless, I rest in the Supreme Self. I rest in God. So, and then three, serve others selflessly. One of the most effective ways to dissolve selfish desire is through selfless action. Karma yoga transforms the restless heart into a generous one. If you're part of a recovery program, a 12-step program, you're aware that one of the first things that happens when you come into a group is that you're invited to make coffee or bring cookies. You're invited to serve. And it's the same at a spiritual center. You're invited to serve, not so that you're working at the center, but to support you on your spiritual path of relinquishing selfish desire. In these turbulent times, the highest strength is not controlling things. It's not control, but contentment. The contentment that's born of inner realization, not outer acquisition. And the soul knows the way to not possess. It seeks naturally to not possess, but to express the infinite, the fullness, the wholeness,